But a lot of them knew, and they had a good idea of what was coming. And then they also have this standard operating procedure, because when a plane goes off course for more than a few minutes, when a plane stops communicating with tower, when a plane turns off its transponder or it breaks and the transponder signal stops coming to tower, when a plane hears from tower but ignores its orders, for more than a few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, there's a procedure, because what you have is called an air emergency. And it doesn't matter if it's a small plane with a few people in it, but it's even more of an air emergency when you have hundreds of people in a commercial plane. And what happens is that the air traffic controller first tries for another 3 to 5 minutes to correct the situation. Is there an error? Is it a mistake? You know, is the transponder broken? What's going on? But if they're not able to do that in a very short period of time, then they alert their supervisor. Their supervisor will either take the other duties away from them or hand that flight off to somebody else. When a transponder goes off, it's very easy also, because it's a non-identified blip on the screen, so it stands out, to tag it with an identifying tag. It's not going to give you as much information as the transponder ID tag does, because that shows you speed and altitude. But they did that, for instance, with Flight 175. When its transponder went off, they put another tag on it, so you don't lose the plane entirely. And then when he goes to the supervisor, there's also a military liaison at the FAA control center. And the military liaison then calls the National Military Command Center, or there's also a National Air Rescue Center, depending on what's happening or what response they think they want. And both of those, one's in Langley, the other's right at the Pentagon in the war room. And then they, in turn, can call NORAD Command, and NORAD has certain bases where planes are on scramble-ready alert. And if they get the signal, they can go up into the air within 6 minutes after being called. And they go up fast, you know, not full burner, till they get to the thin air where they can go faster, and then they can go to 1,800 miles an hour. Now, they don't jump up and run through commercial traffic because they're going too fast. And what they do is that they go up and they fly to a pre-designated point, which is a staging point. And from there, the traffic controllers are going to move the traffic out of the way of the plane that's in trouble, so then they can shoot down that alley, that open area, at 1,500 miles an hour, intercept the plane. And they do a number of things when they intercept. And they try to get radio contact with the plane close. They can fly near the plane and wag their wings and wait for a wing wag response. They have other things they can do to guide the plane, like turn left in front of it and say, follow us. If it won't follow, there's usually two of them. They go in teams. They can sandwich it and to some extent force it down. And they're also looking in the cockpit and to see, you know, what's going on. Why is the plane having trouble? So they did that in this one case they described in detail. Payne Stewart, a golfer, and the cabin pressure went and the people were unconscious, and they went up and then they flew along next to the plane until it eventually crashed. From January to September 2001, in air emergencies, 67 times that procedure happened, and it happened in a timely way, and things went up and they intercepted. Now, if you've got a hijacking, it's a little different. What your protocol is usually, you know, it's a hijacking. You want to keep people safe, so they usually tag it and tail it. They tail behind, but they're there to see what it's doing, and they get it up. But you usually don't know it's a hijacking right away. What you get first is that it's an air emergency. And they had time on September 11th from 8:14 when the first plane went off, and it doesn't hit till 8:45. The next one goes off course about 8:30, and it doesn't hit till 9:05. In each of these four planes, they had ample time, given that standard scenario, to be alerted and to get the NORAD planes up. And General Eberhardt, head of NORAD, under testimony, confirmed that they could have proper notification, gotten the planes up, and at least intercepted these people. That doesn't mean they'd go up with a shoot-down order. That's a whole other stage. But it is also the case that even though they had reduced the number of scramble-ready bases and planes to, I think it's something like 14 nationwide, and they had, you know, maybe 6 or 7 on the East Coast, there's also a Canadian base that traditionally scrambled and followed Russian planes down to New York. And that was still in place that day. And at the NORAD headquarters, where they were having some war exercises for a few days, they had a Canadian commander who would have known about that base and those planes been accessible to it. But in addition to those, any plane can be tasked by NORAD. If there are planes in the air, like for instance Andrews Air Force Base had some jets over South Carolina that were on some maneuvers, they could be called and flown back very fast into the D.C. area, the scenario, if they wanted them. And I found a regulation also that any particular base commander in an air emergency can order his own planes from his base to go up and intercept and try to deal with it. So they weren't out of options. Now, when they got there to testify, not under oath, at the first hearing, you know, which caused a big flap because they didn't do too well, NORAD got up, and first they thanked the commission for helping them prepare their testimony. I like that. I liked it even better when they were under oath at the last hearing. They thanked the commission for straightening out their timeline. I mean, that's like the lawyer for the other side. You know, you thank them at the end. Thanks for straightening me out on what happened, you know. But they thanked them for helping prepare the testimony. And then they said, well, it was fog of war. I don't remember that we were at war that day. It was fog of war, and they just got so confused. And then a year later, CNN went into the war room with General Winfield Montague, who's the head of the National Military Command Center, which would have been the relay point to NORAD. It's the first time they let the press into the war room ever in the Pentagon. The big, we're going to bring in the inner sanctum and tell you the real story here. Well, General Winfield Montague was not really the right guy to ask because he had made arrangements the night before not to be in the command center, had something else to do between 8:30 and 10:30 on the morning of September 11th. I don't know why he's taking his daughter to the dentist or something else, but he was gone. And a young Navy guy, Liedig, was popped into his place, who was his first day on that job. But they get Winnie in there, you know, and they're asking him, well, what happened that day? And he said, well, we didn't respond right away because the FAA was tracking four seemingly unrelated hijackings. Well, I said, can anyone deconstruct that sentence? Four seemingly unrelated hijackings. Do you have to have six unrelated before you go up? Do they have to be related? I mean, you got one hijacking, can't you deal with that? And a second one comes along, deal with them independently? I mean, maybe they weren't related, but we hadn't had any hijackings in 10 years, and you got four planes out of two airports on the same day within a few hours of each other might be related, but, you know. It kind of reminded me when the acoustics people did Dealey Plaza and they found out that one of the shots came from in front of Kennedy, and the Washington Post said that doesn't mean that was a conspiracy. There could have been another lone assassin who came there to shoot him that day. And then they said, and there's no proof that they knew each other. And I said, who knew each other? You know, it was just a good day to shoot the president. Out they came, hunting season. Coming to Dallas, boys. Maybe it was, I don't know. But, you know, whether they were unrelated or not, to sit there until the FAA figures out what's going on is not procedure. And then they asked at that first meeting, they had Jane Garvey from the FAA, and they said a timeline. She said, timeline. She hadn't even thought about bringing a timeline. She rushed back, said, I'll get it for you, and she sent a one-page document, and here's the timeline, one time. At 9:24, we determined that Flight 77 was a hijacking, and we informed the military. We told NORAD at 9:24 that it was a hijacking. Well, long before it was a hijacking in their view from the ground, it was an air emergency. And long before 9:24, the other planes had given many indications to the controllers that they were not only out of control, but that they were under someone else's control, that there were hijackers aboard. They said, we have other planes. The people on the planes were calling in with stories about them and identifying hijackers. People were calling their families. So word was out, but even if it's not a hijacking, it's an air emergency and you respond to it. And inexplicably that day, something that had worked all that time up to then and has worked since falls apart. And that's why I say this is not intelligence failure, this is failure of standard operating procedure. It's failure of standard operating procedure when the woman at Langley lives across the street from four of these guys prior to 9/11, calls four times to the CIA to complain about how they're behaving and shooting guns off at night and keeping her up, and the CIA calls her back the fourth time and says, don't worry about it. It's not standard operating procedure when these guys make a spectacle skeptical of themselves everywhere they go, and people complain. It's not standard operating procedure when somebody gets the idea maybe we ought to check the flight schools, and their supervisors say, no, don't do it. Or Colleen Rowley sends the memo up to get a search warrant for Musawi's apartment, and it has to go under this special court that they've set up, the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and they have a special court, and they know how to do it. You have two elements. You have to show that there's a criminal activity, and you have to show that there's a foreign country involved, some foreign involvement. So they give both of those, and they send that up the chain, and then the supervisor breaks them in half and sends only one of the things up, and so FISA, unlike all the rest of the times when they normally rubber stamp any of these things, turns it down. And so it obstructs the investigation. But if you don't think they know what was coming, read you a little bit. I'll just do it from memory. But it's right in the report. The supervisor for Colleen Rowley in Minneapolis calls headquarters. They don't name these people. They say a supervisor, you know, a headquarters contact. And at headquarters FBI, they complained to them after they sent this FISA request up, and they said, you're just trying to get everybody all stirred up. And the supervisor says, yeah, I am trying to get everybody all stirred up because I'm afraid this guy's going to run a plane into the Twin Towers. This is prior to 9/11. This is the FBI discussion. Then on the next page, they say, like, not only did the FBI, did they try to send it up there, they sent it out to the London and the German offices, I think, of the FBI, the foreign offices of the FBI, and asked them to take a look for this guy and see if he had any connections there, because they said, again, we're afraid that this guy's going to try and attack the Twin Towers. Well, that memo also got routed around by them to the CIA, and the CIA sent it to its London's office, and they quote in here what they said in their memo to their field offices about Mr. Musawi, and they said, we're afraid that we have a suicide hijacker. It doesn't seem to me that that's a very common term prior to 9/11, a suicide hijacker. But they specifically say that's the threat that they're looking into. And of course, these investigations and everything, they don't go anywhere. I found it curious that when they did finally raid Musawi's apartment, there was software on a disk that showed how to fly a 757, and it had somebody's name written on it in felt tip. The name written on a felt tip was somebody he was at the flight school with in Minnesota, a young pilot who later got his license, who happened to be one of the two pilots in Paul Wellstone's plane when it crashed. The other pilot, the older pilot in the plane, had gotten his pilot's license fraudulently. He had lied about the fact that he'd been in prison for several years on a fraud charge, that he still owed money, and therefore, I think, could have been compromised to take something onto the plane. Not that he would have done it thinking he'd hurt himself, but I mean, if somebody has blackmail control or other control, debt control over this guy, they could say, Joe, put this on the plane, deliver it to the other end, and it's not so benign. You see, because something different happened to that plane than what we're being told about. And he was definitely, Wellstone was definitely targeted. But I thought it was just unusual that this pilot, you know, crosses over into the Musawi story. But there's all these things that aren't standard procedure by all of the intelligence agencies, where they formally share information, they let it drop, warnings come in, they're not taken up, or warnings are given and they're apparently ignored. But beyond the warnings, they also had forewarnings to specific people. Okay, there was an MSNBC article shortly after 9/11 that said that the Pentagon brass were warned not to fly that day in advance. Salman Rushdie tells the story that he had special security precautions and he was told he couldn't fly out of Canada and the United States on that day, and that they gave him a security warning. Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, said that his security staff told him don't fly that day. And the information, if you put the different reports together, could have been specific enough to tell you the date, or very close to the date, and the method, and then they were prepared for the method. So they see it coming, but they don't do anything. Well, not only does FAA NORAD fall apart, but also a secondary system falls apart that's very critical. that's operated my whole life growing up in D.C., which is called P-56. It's a restricted airspace around the Capitol. It's the one I read you about here with the lasers not letting you into the Capitol. And that area is the most restricted airspace in the world. It doesn't depend on FAA NORAD. It depends on a separate military command and a command center that used to be Secret Service and FAA that was located out of Dulles. Now they've added on Customs and Immigration, and they've moved it to Langley. But it's still out there. It was called the National Capital Area Regional Command Center. It has some other name now, but that's classified, I guess. But they have a new office, but that was in place. And during my lifetime, I have seen jets come up from Andrews Air Force Base, from the Anacostia Naval Air Station, 135th Wing is right there, and they can jump up into the sky in a few seconds and protect that airspace. And I've seen them go up when I was a kid and chase little planes out that weren't obeying commands to get out of the area. But that day, absolutely nothing goes up. It doesn't come up from the FAA NORAD bases in time. It doesn't come up from the P-56 bases at all until after the Pentagon is hit, and then Secret Service calls Andrews and says, get something up, and they send up two unarmed planes, and then they're ready to, like, smash themselves into the Flight 93, they said, or do something, but, you know. Actually, the only defense we got from the FAA NORAD system was that the pilots at Langley, 130 miles to the south of D.C., were finally activated and told that they were going to New York. And on their way to New York, they were asked to look out their window and see if the Pentagon had been hit. And they confirmed a plume of smoke. So that was our defense that day of this very restricted area around the Capitol. And it doesn't happen just when you get to the Capitol. It has what's called an ADIZ, or an Air Defense Interception or Identification Zone, of 50 miles. So 50 miles out, they start picking up the blips and they're watching them to see what they do. And if they aren't going on track and they aren't responding, then they've got time to get something up there. Not in the report, not mentioned in the report, not, you know, followed out at all, is their own testimony from Mr. Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, that day. And he met with Jane Garvey when the thing started to happen, the second plane hits, they know it's an emergency. He said he was called over to the White House. And so he runs over there. It's a little after 9 o'clock. He goes through some elaborate vetting procedure to get him in. They still have to check to see it's him. And he gets down into the emergency situation room, the operations room, with Cheney. And he overhears this conversation that he says probably happened about 9:24, 9:25 in the morning. And a young guy comes up to Cheney and he says, sir, the plane is 50 miles out. Do the orders still stand? Now, that to me has to be Flight 77. There isn't any other plane in the scenario that gets within 50 miles of D.C., and the timing is good. 9:24 hits Pentagon 9:38. You know, comes in 400 or 500 miles an hour, has to make a loop, so it's 50 miles out at 9:24, 9:25. The plane is 50 miles out, sir. Do the orders still stand? Then he comes back and he says, sir, the plane is 30 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And he comes back one more time, Mineta says. And he says, sir, the plane is 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And then Mineta says, Cheney's head snaps around and he says, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything different? And then when there's moments of that, the plane hits the Pentagon. And I think you have to ask yourself, what orders is he talking about? Is he talking about shoot down orders? Because that's what Mineta thinks he's talking about. Well, what's he going to shoot it down with? There isn't a plane up there to do anything to it. So it can't be a shoot-down order. Besides, if it was a shoot-down order, you wouldn't be tracking the distance between the bogey and a city. You'd be tracking the distance between the interceptor to shoot it down and the bogey itself. In other words, we're 5 miles from the target, sir. Do we shoot it? That's a stand-down order. He's coming back saying, the order still stands. It's 30 miles from us, sir. I don't see what else it can be. And it's right there in the testimony, and the timing and everything else destroys the phony version that they give you, that they didn't know Flight 11 hit the second tower and some air traffic controller thought it was coming south, and so they followed this phantom jet. Followed a phantom jet with what? Where's the blip? And who's got it on the radar? Who's guiding you to it? Now, that's supposed to be what Langley was doing. Otis, even more interesting, the Otis pilots go up. And they go out to Whiskey 105, and they're waiting for their instructions. The second plane still hasn't hit. The first plane's already hit by the time they get them up, but they're out there looping, and then they're looping, and they're looping, and they're looping, and nobody clears a path, nobody gives them a designator, nobody gives them a target. And finally, after the second tower is hit, they're told to fly into New York. And they were at one point aware, this is according to someone who works at Otis Air Force Base who talked to these specific pilots, they told them that they were aware from radio chatter. Because by about 8:24, a communication bridge opens between all of the agencies. The DOD, the FAA, everybody's on the line. They're talking about what's happening. 8:24. Okay, this is before the first tower is hit. They're all yakking. And, of course, that chatter goes to these pilots through the military command. So they know that a plane is coming to D.C. And they turn, the Otis planes in New York, turn to intercept Flight 77. And they're called back. Now, there's also an air traffic controller that's in the report at the Boston when this stuff starts to unravel before the towers are hit, but two planes are showing signs of being hijacked. They call on their own to Otis Air Force Base and to Pomona Air Force Base in New Jersey. Now, Pomona used to be, it's 177th Air Wing, Air National Guard, they used to be a scramble base for NORAD for the East Coast because they're equidistant between New York and D.C., but in Bosnia, they took them off that duty and shipped them overseas for a while. But that morning, there are two F-15 jets ready to go out on the runway to take off for bombing runs that they do every month. And the two pilots are sitting out there, and we talk to them later. And they're getting a little noise, and they're wondering what they're supposed to do. So this call is coming into Pomona in a timely fashion. But these pilots then told us for the first time in their career they were called back off the runway. So they don't go up. And Flight 75 literally flies over Pomona on its way in, the second tower hit. Flies right over top of them while they're sitting under orders to stand down at that airport. Nothing goes up from Anacostia. Nothing goes up from Andrews. No other planes are tasked in the air until it's basically just too late for anybody to do anything about it except Flight 93, possibly, but they don't even go after 93, at least not out of D.C. And they said it was fog of war. Then they said that they only had radar from the Cold War and all of it pointed outwards, like 180-degree radar, not 360-degree radar. Like they put it at the edge. So, like, you know, if you got through the first layer of defense, we're lost. They're only looking outwards. They can't see anything inwards. But then I went and got their own newsletter, and they're bragging in there about how when the FAA, which doesn't have full coverage of the country in its radar, mostly just around the main commercial areas, they'll sometimes lose a plane, and they would call NORAD, and they would say, could you look on your radar logs or where you are and see if you saw this plane and do a trajectory on us and tell us how to find it because it's missing. So they're bragging about how FAA relies on them inside the country to find the things that even FAA can't see, but they're telling the commission that they can only see one direction that day, outward. And so they couldn't even track the planes inside. It is a massive fraud. I mean, anybody listening to this with any sense of what they were doing would know they're just covering their rear ends. And now, of course, with this report, they want to blame it all on the FAA, but the FAA was getting those warnings from outside. And the FAA, some of them, did the right thing. After 9/11, there was actually an incident where the governor of Kentucky flew into D.C. Did you hear about this? And his transponder was off, but he got a special clearance in the FAA to land at National Airport. Mostly private planes don't, because he was coming to the Reagan funeral. So 50 miles out, his plane is picked up. Guess what that is? That's the ADIZ for P-56. 50 miles out, his plane is picked up, and they send up two F-15s, a Black Hawk helicopter, and a Cessna. They got like four agencies now that have to go up there, okay? And because of 9/11, that activation also sends an alert to all the major buildings within P-56. And so here are all the people filing by in the rotunda, the Capitol, the Reagan is in state. They're told, take off your shoes and run. And they all have to run outside the building to see what's going on. And, you know, to get clear of it because this threat is coming in. And then, of course, it's a big embarrassment because the plane wasn't really a threat. And then they say, oh, God, nothing's fixed. The FAA isn't talking to NORAD again, blah, 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 blah. You know who they fired? They didn't fire anybody from the FAA. They fired the guy, the air traffic controller, who started the alert when he was supposed to at the edge of P-56. That's who gets it. So it's not allowed to work even after 9/11. You get fired if you make it work. But it worked up to that day. All these other things worked up to that day. And then they just shut down. They didn't want a commission. They didn't want an investigation. The families started pushing. And you've got this compromised commission. We tried to make it transparent. We tried to make it ask the right questions. We tried to embarrass it in public as much as we could by asking those questions in front of them and the TV cameras. And after they had that first botched meeting with the FAA NORAD, they decided we better stop taking testimony about 9/11. And so they had a series of hearings about policies, about the consolidation of intelligence, about, you know, airline security and all that. So it was upside down. I mean, they were taking testimony on what policy they should adopt before they figured out what happened on 9/11, which tells me that they already had the policies in mind. And the policies coming from these flawed assumptions that they had led to flawed conclusions. And none of them, for the most part, I mean, maybe sending some educational money over to Afghanistan or something, almost none of them are any good as recommendations. They work on these phony false premises, and they basically back up the right to go into the permanent war and to expand these intelligence agencies, also to break down posse comitatus, the wall between military and police function in this country, also to, you know, to set up extra legal situations like these extreme renditions that they've been doing. Now we know it's one Gulfstream plane has flown 300 people to torture centers, always leaving from Washington, D.C., from corporate front up in Boston, and, you know, to put people in categories where they're not under either international or Geneva Court or under U.S. Constitution and call them some special name. All these laws were written in secret and drafted in the White House by Gonzales, who's now the Attorney General, you know, replacing Ashcroft. These people were key to the situation, and then we were given this story by the FBI of who was on the plane. Now, there's some people that speculate there were no Arabs on the plane, but that's not the case. And in fact, I did talk to ground crew who take tickets and go on the plane and count, but they don't take off with the plane, who saw some of the people that are pictured in the ID as the suspects get on to Flight 77, and I assume that's similar on other flights. Other people got on, who knows, I mean, maybe I'd assume name but the right picture, but they saw some of the people pictured get on the plane, and one of the guys that got on the plane had been on that flight before, prior to that, and had caused some trouble, asking five or six times if he could go up into the cockpit, and he had also filmed some of the airline attendants going in and out of the door of the cockpit. And so the manifest, because I went to the manifest quite early, and the airlines have to report who's on the plane because they're going to be sued, and they had all these American names, and they didn't have any Arab names, but each total that they said this is X number of people, passenger and crew, was short four or five names. When you actually counted the names, they didn't add up to the total complement. Now, if the 19 names had matched the manifests, don't you think they would have wanted to put them out to prove that? I mean, the only way I could think that they would leave them off the manifest is that somebody had to tell them to do that. And to this day, they're reluctant to release the manifests or any of the information. And so I think they were told to leave them off because they didn't, in fact, match the official story. And then, interestingly enough, when they did the DNA work at the Pentagon and the dead there, they come up similarly just short, six names short, and none of the Arab names are on the DNA list either to be identified. So whoever these people's identity is, it's always a step away. And I believe there also were six on Flight 77. There were six people missing from the manifest. There's six names missing from the DNA list. But I also believe it because, and it's in the report, they may make nothing of it, Renee May, the attendant, called by cell phone to her mother and told her that the plane was being hijacked, and she said, "Mom, there's six of them." But the official story is five. And six might explain who flew the plane. It certainly wasn't Hani Hanjour, who couldn't even rent a plane because he flew so bad and wasn't trained as a pilot, but they could have put an experienced pilot on to fly the plane. We don't know who it is, but I think there's yet another name on those planes that's missing from the scenario. And then we went into this situation. You know, first the FBI told us who to blame. And the other day when Michael Chertoff, who's now going to be the head of Homeland Security, came up for approval of the Senate and they took the vote, the last senator that spoke before they started voting was going down his attributes and saying what a great guy he was and why they should approve him. And one of the last things he said right before they voted was, and remember, it's Michael Chertoff's team that linked the 9/11 suspects to the Al-Qaeda. Okay, so that's who you've got in there. And now the Director of National Intelligence, who I thought was going to be Goss, because the reform law says that they can appoint the guy without Senate approval if it's the standing Director of Central Intelligence, which Goss is. In other words, under the law, Bush could make him the Director of National Intelligence and wouldn't even have to get a Senate approval for it. So I thought it would be him. Now I think Goss is the backup position if they can get Negroponte in. But Negroponte is put forward. I mean, and this guy is like the worst that you could imagine. I mean, he's in all these dirty trick operations going way back to Saigon. He was in the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, and he's in Central American operations, and he's part of ContraGate. Well, when I was talking earlier about the funding of the covert operation in Afghanistan, you have half coming through Pakistani intelligence and CIA. The other half, the other $3 billion, comes from Saudi intelligence and the Saudi royal family through the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, which was a front for intelligence operations that involved both American and Saudi. And that funding structure for that covert operation paralleled the funding for the ContraGate operation, as did drugs. They switched from heroin to to the cocaine, but it was, again, Saudi intelligence and BCCI and U.S. intelligence and this drug money that funded CIA Oliver North and the covert operations for ContraGate. And where are those ContraGaters? Colin Powell was the one that did the shipment of the TOW missiles under Poindexter. Poindexter comes back in. Negroponte comes in. Otto Reich comes in. Each of these, and there's even more of them, Elliot Abrams even, some of them were convicted for ContraGate, and yet they're back in as the team at the top of these operations coming into this situation. So, we're being told that's who's going to protect us now are these people. Even Zelikow, who was the director, sat on the 9/11 Commission, sat on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board from 2001 to 2003, and he said recently at the University of Virginia that the real threat of Saddam Hussein was not to the United States, it was to Israel. And that had been the real reason that they had gone in there to invade Iraq was the threat to Israel, but he said it doesn't have, he called it the threat that dare not speak its name. He said they couldn't bring it up because it wouldn't be a popular sell. That was October the 10th, 2002. And then all of these guys have, Chertoff headed up the investigation of 9/11 for the Justice Department from his position in there, but they were drafting illegal laws at the time and dealing with people differently, and there's an intellectual link for that that goes back to the Reich. There's a major jurist that worked for Adolf Hitler who wrote the Reichstag fire law. After the Reichstag was burned down, which again looked like a staged incident where the Nazis put up this young anarchist, shed his shirt on fire, but they had inflammatory materials in there that caused the whole building to burn down, and they blamed it in the national emergency, and they had these Reichstag laws, and they started the beginnings of the open fascism there. And the guy that wrote those laws and wrote much of the racial laws and was the leading jurist for Hitler through the war was the mentor of a guy who came then from Germany to the University of Chicago named Strauss, Leo Strauss, and he in turn was the mentor for Wolfowitz and some of these major neocons. Okay, and there's a quote in 1936 from Hermann Goering where he says, "I know two types of law because I know two types of men, those who are with us and those who are against us." Am I ringing any bells for you? Okay, so you set up a dual legal system, and that's part of what they're doing, and how it's breaking down is they write laws in secret that Congress doesn't even have to approve of. They just implement them, you know. And, you know, there's other stuff breaking about the threats. There's a memo out from Richard Clark, January 25th, 2001, to Condoleezza Rice. We need a primaries meeting. We got to do something about this. And it's not followed up on. And she gets these urgent warnings. But, you know, they say later, well, you know, we did this or we did that. But basically, this report has been suppressed until now. It's mentioned a lot in the testimony and congressional hearings, but we've never been able to see the wording of the actual report. Sybil Edmonds, a whistleblower, also is backing up from her testimony that she saw letters that said at the FBI that they knew that Al-Qaeda would attack American cities with airplanes. And this report that's just come out backs her up, and she's gone into court. And there's some other whistleblowers that are trying to do something to get the truth out about this. But it's, you know, it's uphill against this kind of a system. I also brought with me, and if you haven't seen these, you should probably try to get them. This is called First Impressions. It's the American Muslim Perspectives on the 911 Commission Report by the American Muslim Task Force, and it's available from American Muslim Task Force on online. And then this is the 120-page redacted, still somewhat redacted, last monograph from the 911 Commission staff. But both of them have important stuff in it. And then the best antidote to the report is Paul Thompson's Terror Timeline, which is just a factual timeline with public sources for what happens in the coming up into 9/11 and then minute by minute during it. But there's homework to do. I know it's a post-literate society, and I know the FBI wants to know what everybody's reading at the library. I don't think they could probably deal with my list. But that's why I never did Freedom of Information on myself. I don't have room for all the files. But I think this is just one piece, but the reason that I focused on 9/11 is the same reason I focused on the Kennedy assassination when I was young, same reason I focused on Jonestown. These were major propaganda lies being told about things that were recognizable to the whole American public. And this lie of 9/11 has been used as the trump card to beat us down into accepting the permanent war economy and the civil liberties and all the rest of it. And so cracking this lie, if it can be cracked, I don't think it can be cracked by throwing urban mythology at it, but I think it can be cracked. But it has to be understood at a much higher level than what most people are going after. You know, it's not the mechanics that are going to crack it. It's really understanding a covert operation and what is the source of it. And we don't have all those pieces yet. We don't even have enough pieces to prove whether it came from inside or was just allowed to happen. But it's not impossible to get those pieces or to break this report down with its own testimony and with what little they've given us already contradicts the conclusions that it reaches. But I think it's important to try to crack it and crack it in a way that ordinary people can look at it and see the question, because people are questioning it. The families themselves said 70% of their questions that they had were not answered by the commission. And ordinary people have questions about it if you make it clear to them. You know, and I think that it's possible to use that then as a leverage to get people to ask about the deeper questions about the control of their life and the lack of a real democracy here. But I think not only are we in the place where the German people were in September of 1939 in terms of our responsibility and the threat of the rise of global fascism, because Mussolini called fascism corporatism plus reaction. He said it was when the state and the corporations merged into one. All right? And that is objectively what fascism is. Fascism is not Adolf Hitler, an anti-Semite that decides to get a whole country to go along with killing all the Jews and tries to take over the world. It is an objective economic and political reality that develops from the final stages of monopoly capitalism. When wealth concentrates to a particular level, and when technology moves forward at a particular level, human labor becomes expendable. The first people killed in the Holocaust were the mental patients. Because they were useless eaters, they were taking up space, they were Untermenschen. The American Psychiatric Association, the World Psychiatric Association, the World Eugenics Associations were like this. They believed that they could clean the gene pool out. In fact, the defense at Nuremberg was, why are you taking us to court for this? You started mass sterilization in 1928 in the United States. You started getting rid of these people that didn't fit in the gene pool and the feeble-minded. You taught us how to put people into concentration camps with what you did to the Native Americans. And we're just doing what you did, so why are you taking us to court? I mean, one genocide doesn't justify the next, but it's a legitimate question that we seem unable to ask. I mean, we blame the rest of the world for what basically we've done and the situations that we've set up. And these things are being done in our name. I mean, after 9/11, all these people said, well, why do they hate us? You know, and I was like, well, if you don't know history, and many people don't because they don't teach it in school, you don't know what's being done in your name abroad for the last 50 years. But the people in those countries know. They know the corporations that came in. They know who came in and stole their labor. They know who put the dictator in that repressed them. They know where the money was coming from. They see what the relations are to the U.S. military and the U.S. State Department and the embassy there. They're not fooled. But the American people have to be kept in the dark about it. Because it's being done in their name. And so we feel that we're benign. You know, don't we give a lot of foreign aid to people abroad? Yes, 70% of it happens to be weapons. We're the good guys and the rest of the world is evil. And we don't understand why anybody would hate us. And then they came out and told us that bin Laden is attacking us because we're a large, pluralist, democratic, rich country. And they just can't stand that. And I said, well, why aren't they bombing Canada too? Could it be something to do with Canada's foreign policy, maybe? I mean, it's not to justify the deaths. It's a crime against humanity, what happened on September 11th. But it's a crime, not an act of war. It should have been dealt with, as Nuremberg was, in an international tribunal. The Taliban said three times they would turn bin Laden over to an international tribunal, and Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. But that was the proper response, not the wars that they wanted to go into and all of that phoniness. But they've got us so afraid of each other and afraid of everybody else around the world, and that's, I mean, it's a classic protection racket. You know what a protection racket is for the mob? You know, the window in your store gets broken and Louis comes by. Good, sorry about the window. $100 a month or so would probably make sure that don't happen again. But you don't want to pay it, you know, something worse could happen. A place could burn down or something. That's a protection racket. I mean, I'm supposed to be more afraid of bin Laden in his cave, you know, Dr. Nosama, where's James Bond, than I am of the system, you know, that created the cave and that created the threat and that armed the threat and, you know, that as far as I can tell manipulates the threat, maybe as a negative asset, maybe as a positive asset. I don't know, but I mean, I'm afraid of the people that are taking my life and my democracy and the lives of people all around the world away. It's like Malcolm X said, if you read the newspapers long enough, you'll end up loving the people doing the oppressing and hating the people being oppressed. And you've got to figure out what that is. But the other thing you have to figure out, I think, is what fascism is, because the fascism, that corporatization, is now not just a couple of, it's not Tyson Steele and IG Farben, it's international global corporations. It's Hitler gone global, gone mad. I mean, he might have wanted to take over the world, but the corporations that were financing him weren't already the world and didn't own so much of it. And so, you know, it's a global lineup of these countries at the top, the United States and the European Union and the new wannabes. China joins the World Trade Organization September 12th. First call to Bush is from Putin and Russia, you know, and they want to line up, and then the rest is the pockets of resistance within the neoliberal countries, and the underdeveloped masses, those are expendable, and then us, I mean the people here that are going to resist. Okay. And overall, when you don't need the labor anymore, I mean they don't need the labor in Iraq to run those oil wells. So that population is expendable to them. And then based on where your racial views are, based on whatever, you know, your genetic views, whatever, you're going to pick those segments in the society that can go first or that you're not going to worry about. Maybe you'll speed it up a little. Reinhard Gehling suggested that the concentration camps, he was Hitler's head of intelligence, in his memoirs at the end of the war were too messy and that they ought to figure out how to create natural disasters that wipe out hundreds of thousands of people at a time. But the objective pressure of that concentration of wealth, if you're not going to make that surplus, and that's what it is, objectively the world is in surplus. Objectively, there is enough arable land, there is enough resources, there is enough technology for every single person on earth to be clothed and housed and fed, to have medical care, to have transportation, to have communication, to be interneted even, to be entertained, without the destructiveness to the rest of the planet, without wiping all the rest of the species, without destroying the ozone layers and all of that. There are ways that would work, but it takes a decentralized model to make them work. It takes a community model to make them work. But they're there. Objectively, they're there. And if all you do with that surplus is control it and consolidate it into the hands of a few, then the rest of us are the Untermensch. That's just the there's an objective pressure for genocide because you don't need those people and they potentially represent a threat to you. And then certainly along the racial lines where you dehumanize whole segments of the population. So that's sort of the nightmare path, and of course it also takes a permanent war economy and permanent war and civil dissent, you know, end of the Constitution, martial law and all those things. That's the nightmare path, but we're at that crossroads now. We don't have a lot of time. We don't have all the wiggle room we could. We've got more wiggle room than anyone else on earth to not go down that path, to change that path in the other direction toward a world that's different. But in order to build that world, you have to have the imagination to understand not only what your enemy is and what form it takes, but of this global fascism and these international relations and the economic relation that capitalism forces all of us into with each other and how that could be broken. You know, how you pull back aspects of human community that have been stolen from you and then sold back to you in their most distorted form by this system. But you also have to have the imagination to see what a real democracy would look like. And I would submit to you that the democracy envisioned by Thomas Jefferson was not adequate in his mind for the following generation. And he said it himself. He said there will probably have to be a revolution in this country every 20 years to make sure that power doesn't aggregate again in the hands of the few. He said he wouldn't expect his children to wear a threadbare coat just that he owned just because he liked to wear it. He said if he built a fort around them to protect them from a threat and the threat went away, he wouldn't force them to live in the fort any longer. He said that if he planted a tree so they could have fruit to eat and they didn't like the fruit, he wouldn't force them to eat it. These are his metaphors for he knew that his imagination only stretched so far and that then every subsequent generation would have to imagine and realize its own freedom, its own sense of democracy. The other thing Jefferson realized in Washington as well is that parties, political parties, are inimical to democracy. Jefferson said that in any given society, you can only have two parties no matter what they call themselves. Those who want to take power from the people and put it in the hands of the few, he called the aristocrats. Those who want to do the reverse and put power in the hands of the people, he called the democrats. But he said if you build a democratic government machinery and you build a constitution that's actually democratic and a social contract that's democratic, you don't need a democratic party. And Washington, when he left office, said that policies belong to the people as a whole. And that parties put those decisions back in the hands of a few. When you lived in the 1700s, your only method of communication and travel was either a horse or a boat. When the meeting you had to go to was going to be 2 days away by horse, The whole community couldn't go, so you picked a representative to go. Smaller community, maybe not too far fallen from the tree. You probably picked the guy you wanted around the least and sent him off for 2 weeks to listen and be your representative and then bring back the report. We're in the 21st century. We don't rely on a horse and a boat. We have mass communication. It's a commonwealth. You'll say the corporations own the media. They don't own the media. They monopolize the licenses. But the licenses are issued on the basis of it being a commonwealth, and they're issued by the public to the broadcasters. They own some of the broadcasting equipment. That hardly seems insurmountable. But it is still a commonwealth that belongs to all of us, and it's our public media. So we should take back sufficient time to raise issues with each other and debate them in an open way, and then everyone participate in the decision-making power that we should have, because that's the power that belongs to all of us. And we know by now, don't we, that any representative that we would put in our stead can be blackmailed or bullied or bulleted or bribed. It's not so hard to control 400 or 500 people. It's a little harder when the decisions rest in the hands of us all. And it can be done in a fair way. It can be done in an open way. You also have to break open the commonwealth of the educational system here so that people get real information. See, government, Jefferson said, given a choice between a government without a newspaper and a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter, because he understood that the flow of information is more central to the democratic process than the machinery you set up to carry it out. But that's all that is machinery that you set up to carry out your vision of democracy. And if it ain't working, then you dismantle it and you put some machinery together that makes it happen in the right way. And, I mean, I don't vote for representatives. I have two buttons. One says if voting worked, it would be illegal. And the other says don't vote, it only encourages them. Okay. I would gladly vote for a referendum, but not the kind of referendum they have out and in issues they have in many of the places out here, because those are rigged so that only the rich can get enough signatures to get over the hump. But if you made it voting registration automatic, if you made it very simple to put something on the ballot and then maybe chose what were the most popular ones for each month and ran them, then you could debate them and you could choose by them. But there's no reason not to be making those decisions, especially when they affect lots of people, and not to be making them on a decentralized level. Not all on some kind of a national or state level, but a decentralized level that thinks globally and acts locally, but also does the reverse, that when it acts globally, it thinks locally. And you can put those two things together, and then if you're going to pay taxes, and I would say, there is alternative of alternate money and not having a money or a tax system and all that. But if you're going to pay taxes, we have a bumper sticker in D.C. that says taxation without representation, because we don't even have a voting representative. We have Eleanor Holmes Norton who can go and sit on a committee, but you can't vote. Now, my version of representation with taxes is not Eleanor Holmes Norton voting for me, because she doesn't represent me. I doubt I could represent anyone else in the room here, much less all of you. Why would I want to try? I can represent myself perfectly well, as can you. And if your response to this is, yeah, but people are too stupid, Jefferson thought of that too. He said, the only safe repository for power is in the hands of the people. He said, if you think them unable to exercise their discretion in a wholesome fashion, that means you think they're idiots. Okay. He said, the solution is not to take the power from them and put it in the hands of an elite. The solution is to inform their discretion. That you have to trust rationality, you have to trust communication, and the ability that we can educate each other and ourselves about things. Does it mean we'd never be wrong? No. But I would tell you, we will fix a mistake sooner than this system will fix a mistake, and we won't vote for things that are obviously not in our own self-interest on a broader scale. Will there be differences? Of course there will be. But breaking through some of those other things would make it possible. But if I was going to pay tax to the federal government, I think that I would want the last page of the tax form to be an allocation form. Now, that would be taxation with representation, because I would directly allocate the tax that I paid. And I even want to just send a three-part carbon out to everybody that pays taxes in my community and show them a brochure with a pie. Here's where your money's currently being spent. Here's your blank pie. Fill it in. Put it in with your tax form. Doesn't have any legal weight, but tell them how you'd like the money to go. Send one to your representative or put it in the drawer and send one back to me. I'll take the results. I'll put them into a people's tax pie. I'll go to the voting record and put up the representative's tax pie. I can guarantee you they won't be the same pie. And then I'll ask the representative to come out and explain who it is that they're representing. It's very simple, but it plants that seed. You've got Bush running around saying, it's your money, it's your money. And I said, yes, it is my money, and I want to allocate it. I don't want the chump change back that's left for social services after you overfund the Pentagon and the CIA. I want to spend the money myself. Okay? And it's a process. I mean, you know, I'm not saying these are magical solutions, but if you don't start thinking of a different way to invent democracy this late, then we are going to go on the nightmare path. And if you don't understand that your loyalty belongs to the human race and not to a flag, not to a country that's supposedly under attack from some mystical force that's out there that you can't understand. I mean, these terrorists, the way they're presented to us is as if they dropped in from outer space. All you know about them is that they hate you and they want to kill you. You can't negotiate with them. You can't talk to them. You can't understand them. All you can do is kill them. And you got to kill every last one, except you never know. It's like the pod people, you know, maybe it spread to somebody else, and then you got to start killing them, you know, and how long is it you start fingering each other? Well, I think you're one of them, you know. And it's just dead end. I mean, if it's the 21st century, we know what war does. And now the weapons that make it happen are so bad that the planet is not going to survive. If we don't make war obsolete, we're going to make ourselves obsolete. Right? And I don't know, I mean, maybe talking to the choir here. I went to Bemidji, Minnesota recently. I had a great time. I talked to people in the community and people at the school and classes of kids and stuff like that. But these ideas are ideas, I think, that aren't beyond ordinary people. But we've got to be willing to break down, even in ourselves, a tendency to want dogma. I mean, I'm not telling you this stuff so you'll follow me around and say, well, I'm a judgist, you know. I mean, I do these things because I'm hoping that a little bit of humor, a little bit of perspective, it'll open up something for you that you'll look at the paradigm a different way. In fact, I wanted to write a memoir. I've been thinking about a title of a memoir would be Brother, Can You Paradigm? All right? Because if you can't paradigm, you're in trouble. You know, and it's not that everything they're telling you is a lie, but the focus, the lens, they've got it a little skewered so that you don't see it straight when you look at it. So, and I'm in trouble already. You can go on the internet and find out that I'm a government intelligence agent and I'm part of a disinformation campaign because I say that Flight 77 went into the Pentagon. I don't think it's a burning question about 9/11. I think there are much bigger questions. But Flight 77 did go into the Pentagon. There were hundreds of witnesses that saw Flight 77 go into the Pentagon. I've talked to quite a few of them. You know, and you've got all these people not only saying, is it a question, but it's a religion. And if we approach our belief systems as religions, then we're going to put people out in the street, you know, and away from us. But if we approach it as respect between two people, and let's see if we can't get to the truth. You know, I often say in my lectures, because people come at you afterwards and say, gee, you talked about this, and my uncle did that, you know, and a little piece of the woman at the picnic table. If we told the stories of our own families, the whole system would break. They do what they're doing because they are deathly afraid of us. They need for us to be in denial. They need for us to try to protect the little bit of privilege we have over somebody else rather than sharing. They need us to keep the needle in our arm, the television on, the consumer mentality going, keep quiet, consume, and die. And they're afraid of us. And they need us to feel that we are powerless. But we are the least powerless people on the planet. And there might be a way for the whole rest of the world to stand up to this juggernaut, but it wouldn't be easy. But where the potential is to stand up for it is right here among us. And the moral responsibility to stand up to it is right here because it's being done in our name and it's being done each day. And we can build another world. We can invent another world. We can include each other. We can build community. We don't have to be afraid of each other, but we have to tell the truth. And once we tell the truth to ourselves and to others, once we pull the needle out of our arm and say, I'm not playing anymore, that's it, game's over.